Press and the Long Island Star Journal. In normal times, 5.8 million local papers were sold each day, but none were to be found this Christmas season. The city had been without them since December 12th, when a strike by delivery workers, which had begun 4 days earlier, forced the publishers to shut down. As far as the New York sports writers were concerned, the Giants' two compelling struggles with the Browns had been oddly ephemeral, witnessed in the gloaming, but not recorded and annotated for history. Only columnists with national syndication, Red Smith among them, were still writing for publication. Smith's work could be seen down the eastern seaboard in the Philadelphia Inquirer, the most popular newspaper in New York that month. To try to fill the vacuum, local television and radio stations pumped up their sports departments and doubled the time devoted to pro football on the nightly newscasts. Even more than in 1956, the rise of the Giants was watched and remembered as a television phenomenon. Every aspect of life in the city was affected by the strike. Holiday sales were down along Fifth Avenue. Funeral service attendance dropped 20% without obituary notices. Travel agents reported business cut in half. Litter basket collections on the city's streets, minus newspaper detritus, were 25% lighter. 10,000 city newsstands were closed. Some sporting events in the area suffered dramatic attendance declines, as much as 25 to 50%, according to a study by students at Columbia School of Journalism. But the Giants had no such troubles. Attendance throughout the NFL had risen another 5% in 1958, and the late rush by New York fueled the increase. Near the end of the third quarter of the playoff win over the Browns, with the Giants holding a 10-0 lead that appeared insurmountable, given the impenetrable nature of their defense, fans began leaving their seats to start the line for tickets to the NFL championship game against the Western Conference's Baltimore Colts, a game that would be held at Yankee Stadium the following Sunday, the third straight Sunday with a major game in the Bronx. The Giants sold 12,500 tickets late that afternoon and another 10,000 by 10 Monday morning, when public ticket sales were halted. Colts fans, in the grip of what Baltimore sports writers called coltophrenia, bought another 15,000 tickets to follow their team to New York. Baltimore was seeking its first title in any major sport since before the turn of the century. The game had an obvious central theme, one that left Lombardi out. On one side was New York's swarming defense, the front four of Katcabbage, Robustelli, Modjelewski, and Greer. The linebackers, Cliff Livingston, Harlan Sver, and Huff, known in the huddle as Sarah, Wanda, and Meg, respectively. The cornerbacks, Lyndon Crowe and Carl Karolivich, and the ball-hawking safeties, Jim Patton and Emlyn Tennell. On the other side was Baltimore's record-shattering offense, led by quarterback Johnny Unitas, end Raymond Berry, tackle Jim Parker, and running backs Alan the Horse Amici from the University of Wisconsin and Lenny Moore. The weather on December 28th was chilly and windy, but there was no snow, and a broad shaft of winter light lifted the Bronx morning. Better conditions than for either of the Browns games. Old 5x5 stayed home in Englewood in any case, his heart doctors ordering him to keep as far away from the excitement as possible. And they said, no lucky strikes. Since there was a television blackout within a 75-mile radius of New York, Harry had to listen to the game on the radio. Commissioner Bell was adamant about the blackout rule. Television might be the future, he said, but it was not everything. He felt an obligation to ticket holders at the stadium who'd paid good money to see something that others shouldn't see for free. Vince and Vincent, father and son, their discomfort soothed on Sundays by a shared passion for the Giants, headed out from Fairhaven early that morning in the family's Big Fin 57 Chevy, two-toned in mauve and white. Vincent thought it looked almost pink. Heading north in determined silence, from Route 35 to the Turnpike, all the way north to the George Washington Bridge, then across the Cross Bronx, and down to the stadium at 161st Street. Walking through the players' gate, credentials out, into the dressing room, looking around at this pride of giants. Frank, so cool always, even now that he's hurting, and Alex, with the whisper of conspiratorial goodwill for Vincent, and Em and Rosie, friendliest of guys, and little Mo and Cat, grinned killers, and Charlie Connerly, the old pro, taping up his old Miss Bag of Bones one more time. New York was crazy for these Giants, and Baltimore for its Colts. Was this the old rah-rah of college, or something more in the spirit of the new and professional? Looking down from the press box, Red Smith, among the few New York writers facing a deadline, tapped out his impressions of the pregame stadium fanfare. From the start of the sunny afternoon, the playground had presented a spectacle rarely seen in this blasé town. Foghorns and sirens hooted and shrieked, bands tootled and postured. Antlered ballet dancers in bright red union suits impersonated cottontail reindeer, a rare breed. Fillies of provocative design paraded wearing the letters Colts across bosoms that pointedly contradicted that label. Vincent stood in his usual place, down the far end of the sideline, admiring those same fillies. His dad was up near Jim Lee, play chart coded and ready. Marie was in the stands with Johnny Ryan and his wife, family friends who had given her and Susan a ride to the game. Susan had finally graduated from washroom towel duty and was seated by her mother. The Giants scored first on a Summerall field goal, but then Gifford fumbled twice in the second quarter. Amici rode in from the two, and Unitas hit Barry at the end of another long drive, and the Colts held a 14-3 lead by the half. Midway through the third quarter, the game looked nearly out of reach. Unitas had moved the Colts downfield again, first and goal inside the five. But this time, the defense held. And when Livingston tackled Amici on fourth down several yards short of the goal, the Giants' offense at last awakened. One long, loopy play brought them back. Rote went deep, caught Connerly's pass, raced toward the Colts' goal, fumbled, and Webster, trailing amid a group of players, Colts and Giants alike, who seemed frozen for a second as they watched the ball bounce, finally picked up the loose ball and ran it all the way to the one. Lucky improvisation, better than any trick play from Lombardi's Bible. Triplett scored from there, and the Giants were back. From the press box, Tex Maul watched with satisfaction as Connerly, his favorite old pro, led New York downfield again early in the fourth quarter, hitting Schnelker on two long passes, then finding Gifford in the flat at the Colts' five, where he out-muscled an arm tackler and glided in for the go-ahead touchdown. Red Smith, looking around, noted that blizzards of paper whirled through the darkening canyon of Yankee Stadium. The score was 17-14 now, Giants ahead, clock running, defense holding, Lombardi's offense fully engaged, getting the ball back, moving again. 2 minutes, 22 seconds left. Third, and a little more than three, at the Giants' 43. Sitting in his living room on Central Avenue, blood pressure rising, Harry's listening to the end game on WINS. Vincent is on the far end of the Giants' bench, gazing up at the sea of noise, shreds of paper falling from the upper deck, hot dog wrappers swirling onto the field, his mother and sister in the stands, his father checking the play chart again next to Jim Lee. Colts think pass. Their linebackers drop back. Connerly goes with Lombardi's favorite. Gifford running for daylight, sweeping right, past the line of scrimmage, and cutting upfield near the down marker. Gino Marchetti, the Colts' terrifying pass-rushing end, is off balance when Gifford cuts, but leans back awkwardly and makes the tackle. On the Giants' side, they think Frank's got it, the first down that wins the game. But there's a distraction on the field. Big Daddy Lipscomb came to the play late and fell on his own man. Marchetti's hurt, writhing. his parents, watching pro football on television for the first time like millions of others, see it in their living room. They never wanted Gino to play football, and now his ankle's broken in the biggest game of his life, and he's carried off the field on a stretcher and laid out in the dressing room where he cannot even follow the rest of the game on the radio. The ref spots the ball, and Gifford looks on in disbelief. The man's putting it back too far. "I made that first down," Gifford would say, forever. But the official ruled otherwise, so what can you do? Inches short. Howell and Lombardi decided to punt, figuring they had a great punter in Don Chandler and an even better defense. Later, the wisdom of this decision would be debated, Red Smith wrote, but it seemed wise then. The Colts took over at their own 14, and Smith described the meaning of the drive. 2 years ago, Baltimore's Johnny Unitas was playing for $6 a game on the Pittsburgh Sandlots. Now he was throwing for the winner's share of $372,310. With a minute and a half left, he passed to Spats Moore for a first down. 1 minute, 5 seconds remained when the Colts reached midfield. The Giants' front four knew Unitas was passing, but couldn't reach him. Robustelli spent all day trying to get around Big Jim Parker with minimal success. All Unitas needed was 3 seconds, and he got it almost every time. He kept working his passes to Raymond Berry, the skinny Colts receiver with weak eyes, one leg shorter than the other, and peculiar tastes like a preference for laundering his own football pants, as Smith described him. Borrowing a phrase that he'd heard from another writer, his close friend W.C. Heintz, Smith called Berry an unprepossessing athlete who had but one incredible talent. He catches passes the way most of us catch the common cold. 2 Berry catches took the ball inside the 20. The clock was down to 7 seconds when big Steve Myra lumbered out, head down, leg locked, and kicked a field goal. Tied at 17 at the end of regulation. The first tie ever in an NFL championship. And it was in New York, on national television, with America caught up in the twilight drama. And there was more. This was the first year of use for Rule 14, Article 1. Under this system, the team scoring first during overtime play shall be the winner of the game, and the game is automatically ended upon any score. When the regulation game ends in a tie after a 3-minute rest, a referee tosses a coin just as he does at the start of the game to determine which team is to receive. The visiting captain calls the toss. Sudden death. Kyle Rote and Bill Svoboda met Unitas at midfield for the coin toss. Unitas, calling tails, lost the toss, and the Giants received. Landry's boys were relieved. 3 minutes was not sufficient rest for them. Their fatigue was not merely physical. Unitas had worn them down. But the offense could not hold the ball, and on 4th and 1, Howell and Lombardi chose to punt again. And there came Johnny U, trotting onto the field one more time in his odd, slump-shouldered lope at his own 20. The tremendous tension held the crowd in massing excitement, wrote Maul. But the Giants, the fine fervor of their rally gone, could not respond to this last challenge. Sam Huff felt the pressure of an entire season as he stared across the line into the Colts' backfield. As the middle linebacker, he was responsible for Amici's threat up the middle, wide slants by Moore or L.G. Dupree, and short passes dumped into the center of the field. He didn't know that Moore was being used only as a dangerous decoy now after suffering a brutal hit in the chest late in the first half. Huff found it almost impossible to outguess Unitas, and Amici was such a running threat up the middle that he couldn't commit too soon on the pass. Unitas sensed that he had the advantage, that the Giants were burdened with all the pressure. He made one calculated gamble after another, keeping New York off balance, leading his offensive unit with what Maul called the cool sang-froid of a card sharp. On the key play of the drive, Little Mo charged through toward Unitas, finally eluding the pass-blocking wall that had stymied the front four so many times. But Unitas had suckered him in, deceived him, leaving a gaping hole on the left side, a free zone grown larger when Huff dropped off to cover Barry on what he expected to be a pass. And there was Amici, galloping through the hole on the fullback trap. By the time Huff caught sight of him, it was too late, and the horse had 23 yards. This happened on the far side of the field for young Vincent. All he saw was Amici's back, more paper falling and swirling, the whole stadium thumping, sideline fillies leaping, his dad yelling, and Tom Landry, the handsome stoic, showing nothing. When Amici went down, finally, so did the broadcast. The exuberant crowd had knocked loose a power TV cable, and the sets went dark for the next 2.5 minutes. During the blackout, the national television viewers in 10.8 million homes, the largest audience ever for an NFL game, missed a Unitas pass to Barry that took the ball down to the Giants' 8. Then a commercial, followed by a Dupree run stuffed for no gain. The sound and picture returned in time to catch Unitas arching the ball high over Livingston in the right flat into the hands of tight end Jim Mutscheller, who was stopped at the 1. No surprise what came next. We all knew the next play was going to be a run, and that Amici would be carrying, but it didn't do much good, Huff later recounted. Mutscheller blocked Livingston, and Moore brushed M. Tunnell, and no one even touched the horse as he came through. And the Colts had won, 23-17. 13 plays of perfect offensive football, Lombardi watching helplessly from the sideline. Sudden death for his Giants. Gifford forlorn. 2 fumbles and the missed first down. He thought he had lost the game single-handedly until Lombardi embraced him and said, "Frank, don't feel bad. We wouldn't have been here without you." It was an uncommonly easy 1-yard touchdown run, but one that immediately entered the realm of sports mythology. In that moment, when Alan Amici took the handoff from Unitas and churned across the goal line in the late December mist of Yankee Stadium, he ran pro football to a place in the American consciousness that it had never been before. The Colts' early lead, the Giants' comeback, Marchetti's broken ankle, Gift's bumluck mark, the daring of Unitas, the hands of Barry, the speed and power of Lenny and the horse, the cunning of Connerly and the grace of Gifford, the ferocity of Huff and Little Mo, the brilliance of Lombardi and Landry, the last-second field goal, the drive, the violence and sudden death, the rise of television, the cult of the professional. It all came together in what the headline over Tex Mall's story called the best football game ever played. The newspaper strike ended the next morning, and in the first days of the final year of the 50s, more of the old gave way to the new. Colonel Blake retired at West Point after a final unbeaten season. Tim Mara, the old man of the Giants, died. Toot Shore sold his old 3-story sports saloon on Manhattan's west side and began looking for a newer spot. And Vince Lombardi left the Giants, heading west to a place that he had once called Godforsaken, where at long last he could bust out of the category in which Sports Illustrated had placed him with its one-paragraph notice of his change of jobs. This might never have happened. 1,000 flits of fate could have taken him somewhere else. Yet his entire football life seemed to have readied him for this moment, when he could carry the mythology of the 4 horsemen and the 7 blocks of granite, the blood of the Izzos, the pragmatic discipline of the Jesuits, the faith of saints, the order and clarity of Red Blake, the no-substitute-for-victory philosophy of MacArthur, the professional cool of the Giants, the cult of the modern, with his leather satchel full of diagrams, his temper and fire and fearsome grin, his mauve and white Chevy, and his struggling little family. Take it all with him, out to Green Bay, Wisconsin, where he had his one best chance to become more than just a face in the crowd. Chapter 11. The Foreigner. Christmas Eve, 1958. Not yet 4:30 in the afternoon, but already the drape of a long December night darkened the city. The old empty streets named for early American presidents. The widening yawn of the Fox River. The winter coal pile rising on the West Bank. The northern firmament vaulted above the bay. Most of downtown had closed at noon, but lights flickered inside the two-story brick storefront office of the Green Bay Packers at the corner of Crooks and Washington. The staff was holding a party, a Yuletide football wake for the nicest guy who ever coached, Raymond Scooter McLean. Some of the men had ventured to a bar down the street and returned clinking bottles of gin and bourbon. One of the clerks brought in a phonograph, and some big band and polka records, and they cleared the furniture in the ticket office and had themselves a fine time dancing on the creaky, soot-streaked floor. Vern Llewellyn, the business manager, Tom Miller, the publicist, Art Daly, the Press Gazette beat man, Ruth McCloskey, and the other secretaries, all were there with Scooter and a few of his pals, brave and lonely souls in a town that had turned against them. McLean had resigned under pressure 1 week earlier, following a season-ending loss on the coast to the Los Angeles Rams. In his only year coaching the Packers, he'd established a new standard of ineptitude, compiling the worst record in team history. 1-10-1, a mark that New York sports writer Red Smith, who'd grown up in Green Bay, later immortalized with the phrase, "The Packers underwhelmed 10 opponents, overwhelmed 1, and whelmed one." Now Scooter was fleeing to Detroit, where he could be an anonymous assistant again under his old Chicago Bears roommate, George Wilson. Packers coaches seemed to be packing up with depressing regularity. Still vivid in McCloskey's memory was the sight 1 year earlier of her previous boss, the fired Lyle Blackburn, trudging down the office stairs with all his personal possessions, mumbling swear words all the way down. Blackburn had lasted 4 losing years, and Gene Renzani 4 losing years before that, and between those two and McLean, the Packers had lost 72 games during the 1950s while winning less than half that many. The team had become pro football's provincial joke. College stars dreaded being drafted by the Packers. When veteran John Sandusky was traded from Cleveland to Green Bay during training camp in 1956, Bob Skoronski, the rookie tackle from Indiana University, greeted him with the words, "John, welcome to the end of the earth." Misbehaving players on the other 11 NFL teams were threatened with trades to the salt mines of Siberia, as Green Bay was known around the league. Commissioner Bert Bell was being pressured by big city owners to fix the Packers or bounce them from the league. The long-running love affair between the people of Green Bay and its football team had also soured. The miracle that such a small town, population 62,888, could sustain a professional club was not enough. It had to win championships, as it had in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Hang 'em high was now the prevailing attitude, best expressed by the effigy of Dominic Olenichik, president of the Packers' board of directors, that swung from a lamppost outside the office a few nights before Scooter's departure. Olenichik had been president for only 1 year himself and was under scrutiny from all sides. He'd arranged McLean's forced resignation, but many fans were still not satisfied. Ole, as he was called around town, was short and bulky, a self-made man with a florid complexion, watery eyes, and a soft, gravelly voice. A one-time disciple of Bob La Follette and the Progressives, he'd recently completed 5 terms as mayor, but public office was nothing compared to the stress he felt running the Packers. The unencumbered communal judgment went like this. If the Packers stank, Ole stank. Whether it was an earnest committee or a bloodthirsty cabal of conspirators depended on one's perspective. But a group of men had been convening at the American Legion Sullivan Wallen Post No. 11 for several months, secretly drafting plans for a massive reorganization of the Packers' management. The Legionnaires, with no real power to force the matter, nonetheless acted with a sense of entitlement, as did almost everyone in Green Bay when it came to the football team. The Packers were unique in professional sports as a publicly owned, non-profit corporation with 1,698 local shareholders who had bought non-dividend stock at $25 a share in 1949 when the team was on the brink of financial ruin. The largest share of stock was controlled by the Legion Post, to which all profits from the sale of the club would go in the improbable event that the team was put on the block. Around tables in the smoky Legion Hall, otherwise stoic men grumbled for Ole's head. Although Olenichik, like McLean, was a good-natured fellow, in that respect, he was not especially popular inside the Packers' offices on the night of Scooter's wake. The revelers took out the effigy of him that had been cut down from the lamppost and carried it around as a prop of ridicule for their Christmas Eve merriment. At one point, a woman picked up the sheeted broomstick and danced a wild polka with it, shouting, "Now, Ole, you behave yourself!" Olenichik was not the brightest figure in Green Bay. He was scorned by the social elite, who made him the butt of Polish jokes, embarrassed by his rough and bumbling ways. But he had the scrappy survival instincts of a real estate developer, and he knew one thing above all else about his future and that of the Packers. For either to survive, they could not afford another coach like Scooter McLean. Not even the players and sports writers wanted another Scooter, and they genuinely liked the man. Some people claimed that McLean's main problem was that he had been a Chicago Bear, as had Renzani. How could a Bear coach the rival Packers? No more Bears! But McLean's deeper failing was that he acted like one of the guys. Scooter chose to hang out with the players and sat down for poker games with them at training camp and on the road. He was carefree with the cards and his money and usually lost. Owing money to players is not the best way for a coach to gain their respect. He thought Max McGee and Billy Houghton were his gambling buddies, apparently unaware that they enjoyed playing with him because they cleaned his clock all the time. One night, three of the Packers, Gary Kanafel, Tom Bettis, and Johnny Simank walked by McLean's hotel room on their way to dinner on the eve of a road game in Washington and looked in on the scene. Smoke curling toward the light above a card table. Change jingling, bets going around. When the coach caught sight of them and told them to make sure they returned in time for bed check. They looked at each other in disbelief. Imagine Scooter telling us that, Kanafel said later. He was a great guy, but he had no leadership qualities. He wasn't demanding. If you've been around ballplayers, you know they'll take you to the hilt every time. They'll drive you. They'll get everything they can out of you. And we took Scooter in every way. In the locker room, after losing to the Bears in Chicago, McGee and Paul Hornung told McLean that they wanted to stay overnight in the city rather than ride the train north with the team back to Green Bay. "No way," Scooter said to them in his New England accent. But after a bit more pleading, he relented, cautioning that he didn't want to read about them in the paper. So Hornung and I go down to see Don Rickles at the Playboy Club, and he sees us and takes a shot at us in front of everybody, and then we go to Chez Paris and end up with a couple of those dancing girls, and we got back to Green Bay just in time for Tuesday morning practice, McGee said later. And there's Scooter sitting at his desk. "Get in here, guys. Look here." And he points at Cup's Corner, where Irv Kupcinet writes about how Hornung and McGee, after losing to the Bears, were seen dancing with Chez Paris adorables at 2 a.m. And he tried to put his foot down. Never again. When he said he was fining us, it pained him more than it pained us. It was hard for Scooter to get tough. There were few rules in the McLean regime. Curfews were flexible and roundly ignored. No dress code. Players wore whatever they wanted on the road, sometimes sweatshirts. Scooter himself was rarely seen in coat and tie. Players skipped team meetings, often unnoticed by Scooter, who had a habit of drifting into daydreams when the film projector was running. The story, probably apocryphal, but representative of the way his old players remembered his era with equal parts pity and scorn, goes that once he fell asleep in the middle of a film session and awoke to find himself alone in the room, the projector whirring. Bart Starr, a young quarterback out of Alabama who had been raised in a military family, accustomed to discipline, felt lost and uncomfortable with Scooter. Miserable, sickening, disappointing, testing, Starr said of the 1958 season. As the losses accumulated, Scooter lost confidence, and Starr saw no rational pattern to his selection of plays or use of players. If you made an error, you went out, and if the other guy made an error, you went back in. Not only does it test your resolve, it tests your reasoning, where you're going wrong. You're not accomplishing what you want to. It was a tough, terrible year. Hornung, the Heisman Trophy winner from Notre Dame, grew more dispirited as the season deteriorated, uncertain where Scooter would play him in the backfield, fullback, halfback, quarterback, and unhappy with an atmosphere in which many players seemed more interested in their statistics than the team's success. He wanted to be traded and thought about quitting. It was very individual, Hornung said later. Those guys in Green Bay that year didn't give a shit about winning or losing. Scooter cared, but had no clue how to lift his team. On the way to work each morning, he stopped at Paul's Standard Service on South Broadway and commiserated with Paul Mazzolini, the gas station owner, a longtime Packer fan who'd been a water boy for Curly Lambeau's team back in the early 1920s. Paul, what am I doing wrong? What's happening? Mazzolini remembered McLean asking him. He'd get very emotional, and he started to cry. He could see his job was on the line. Olenichik and his executive board, a who's who of Green Bay merchants, bankers, lawyers, and civic leaders, also cared about winning and losing. They had to, considering the pressure they were under from league owners and the demanding local citizenry. With funds raised through a municipal referendum, they constructed a new 32,150-seat city stadium on the west side of town. Vice President Richard Nixon had attended the opening ceremonies in 1957 and needed to fill it with fans if they were to remain solvent. With every loss, the board interfered a bit more openly with Scooter's decision-making, demanding that he appear before them every Monday to explain what had gone wrong on the field the day before and outline his plans to correct the team's glaring mistakes. One prominent member of the executive board was Tony Canadeo, the Grey Ghost, a former star Packers running back out of Gonzaga University. Canadeo landed a job selling steel after his playing days ended and stayed in Green Bay, one of some 30 Packers alumni still in the area and all embarrassed at the depths to which the team had fallen. The weekly grilling of McLean was humiliating and depressing but unavoidable, according to Canadeo. When you haven't won a gold darn game, you want to know what's going on. If you don't ask, you're being a jackass. Scooter, hell, I knew Scooter and played against him and liked him. But Scooter had no control of the team. Deep down in his heart, he knew things had to change. Ray Scott, the announcer from Pittsburgh who had launched Pro Football's national television debut on the Dumont Network 5 years earlier, was broadcasting Packers games for CBS in 1958 and quickly discovered that players were manipulating McLean through the executive committee. If you were a Packer who knew someone on the committee, and you thought you should be getting more playing time, you'd go to a committee member who'd go to the coach, Scott said. Oh, it was awful. The local sports writers were easier on Scooter. He was close friends with some of them, played poker with them, too, in a weekly game that moved from house to house. When it was his turn to host the game, he asked Art Daly if he could borrow a poker table. It was a scene that Daly would not forget. The octagonal felt table wouldn't fit into Scooter's car, so the muscular coach held it with his left hand outside the driver's side window while steering the car with his right hand down the streets of Green Bay. For a softy, as Daly said, Scooter was one strong little guy. Unlike many coaches, he never tried to keep the press away or snapped at reporters after a difficult loss. When we got beat by Baltimore that year, 56-0, the feeling was, well, you know, what the hell, according to Daly. It got away from him. There was a friendly, good feeling, and we all felt bad for him. On New Year's Eve, his last night in Green Bay, Scooter ended up at Daly's house at 2 a.m. No hard feelings by then about his brief, dreary time at the top. He took it all right. What the hell? Only won one game. They cooked some eggs and drank a final round of toasts to Auld Lang Syne, and then Ray McLean scooted to Detroit. Lombardi was in the kitchen at Lockwood Place, standing near the rose-colored cabinets, when he took the first call from Green Bay. On the other end of the line was Jack Vannesi, a young personnel manager for the Packers, who was conducting his own covert search for a new coach. "I don't have the authority to make this call, but I'm curious to know whether you're interested." Vannesi began. Lombardi had just started an off-season job as a public relations executive at Federation Bank and Trust, where the Giants kept their deposits. He was trying to overcome his annual postseason depression by taking to his new job as though he might someday coach a bank. First, he had to learn all the plays and players. So he spent several hours during his first week interviewing tellers and loan officers to find out what they did and how they did it. He'd even entertained the seditious notion of abandoning football for the banking life. More money, more time to golf. But there were only 12 head coaching slots in the NFL, and those were the jobs he coveted most, even though he'd already turned down one in Philadelphia. The Packers were offering something the Eagles could not: full control of the club as coach and general manager. Yes, he told Vannesi, he was interested. Jack Vannesi was the bright light of the Packers' staff, professional, energetic, with an uncanny ability to find football talent. His intention was to prevent Olenichik and the executive board from making another hiring mistake. And in characteristically thorough fashion, he'd scouted Lombardi before calling him. He'd studied Vince during the playoffs against the Browns and Colts, and interviewed the smartest football men he knew: Paul Brown of Cleveland, George Halas of Chicago, Bert Bell in the commissioner's office, Red Blake at Army, all of whom said the same thing. Lombardi was their man, the best assistant in the country, ready to prove his merit as a head coach. Trying to steer the Packers president to the right choice while making him think it was his own, Vannesi told Olenichik to consider talking to Brown, Halas, Bell, and Blake. Lombardi would be a tough sell. A New Yorker, Italian, from the other conference, unknown in the upper Midwest, with no head coaching experience above the high school level. And there were as many job seekers as members of the Packers' 45-man board of directors. Top names being floated by different factions included Blanton Collier, coach at Kentucky, Otto Graham, the former Browns quarterback, Jim Trimble of the Hamilton Tiger Cats in the Canadian Football League, and Forrest Evashevsky, whose Iowa team had just won the Rose Bowl. Even Earl Lewis Lambeau, the inimitable Curly, founder of the Packers, who'd moved to California when his 30-year-old coaching career had ended, was seeking consideration, claiming he was the only one who could revive the fallen pack. Days after Scooter's dismissal, Lambeau sent a wire from Palm Springs promoting himself for general manager, then flew back to Green Bay, met with Ole over the Christmas break, and began drumming up a public relations campaign on his own behalf led by Fritz Van, a local radio announcer. Green Bay was susceptible to appeals from the past, especially from Lambeau. It was an inward-looking town whose culture was rooted in the rituals of church, family, neighborhood tavern, and the Green Bay Packers. And Curly, the big jovial Belgian, held the status of local patron saint. His rise had paralleled Green Bay's growing identification with football. He had starred at Green Bay East High, then played briefly with George Gipp in a Notre Dame backfield coached by the fabled Newt Rockne. When he dropped out of Notre Dame and returned home in 1919, he persuaded a local meat packer, the Indian Packing Company, to sponsor a football team, and 2 years later brought the Packers into the American Professional Football Association, the predecessor of the NFL. The history of Curly Lambeau and Green Bay football was as glorious as it was tenuous. His first team, which played against clubs in Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula, was a powerhouse, winning 10 straight and outscoring the opposition by a total of 565-6. Typical score, Green Bay 87, Sheboygan 0. The Packers' specialty was the forward pass, with the freewheeling Lambeau once tossing 45 in a game and completing 37. Matters on the financial side were less splendid. The team played its home games at an open field next to Hagermeister Brewery and did not charge for admission, collecting donations by passing the hat. By 1922, the Packers were on the verge of bankruptcy, and Andrew Turnbull, business manager for the Press Gazette, stepped in to save them. With a group of businessmen known as the Hungry Five, always hungry for money, Turnbull turned the Packers into a stock corporation, selling shares at $5 each. Lambeau brought in a series of colorful stars over the ensuing years. The rambunctious halfback, John McNally, known as Johnny Blood. The quarterbacks, Cecil Isbell and Arnie Herber. The fullback, Clark Hinkle. And the greatest receiver of his era in professional football, Don Hutson of Alabama. The NFL record book had a page entitled, Records Held by Don Hutson. With George B. Calhoun, sports editor of the Press Gazette, cheering them on with daily stories, the Packers became one of the dominant teams in the NFL, winning 6 titles under Lambeau, including 3 straight from 1929 to 1931. But when the team started losing in the post-war years, the town's unlikely claim to a professional football franchise became endangered. In the old days, Lambeau had survived by his wits, once persuading a fan to auction his roadster to keep the team out of hock. By 1949, the team's debts had reached a point where that sort of improvisation would not help. Professional football had long since left the other small towns where the game had got its start. Places like Decatur, Illinois, Hammond, Indiana, Canton, Ohio. Green Bay, barely hanging on, turned to its citizens again for help, transforming the club into a non-profit corporation and issuing $125,000 worth of stock, with no stockholder allowed to have more than 200 shares. The move saved the city's team for better and worse. On the plus side, by spreading the ownership to more than 1,000 local shareholders and prohibiting a single majority owner, the Packers were assured of never being moved from Green Bay. On the negative side, there was no single wealthy owner who could dip into his own reserves to buy players, and the distribution of power among directors and executive directors made the administration of the team exceedingly contentious. Now here came Curly Lambeau again, a decade later, seeking a second chance. In many respects, Lambeau was the Packers. But Olenichek and his allies on the executive board, especially Canadeo and Vice President Dick Bourgonon, a progressive-minded real estate man, were skeptical of Curly's resurrection effort. They remembered his hapless final 2 years as coach in 1948 and 1949, when he was burned out and the team faded into mediocrity. Curly to them was a remnant of the era when pro football was a minor sport populated by tramp players. In the spirit of the new, his days were done. Following up on Venisi's early scouting work, Ole and members of the executive committee called around the league to check on possible coaches, heard good comments about Lombardi, and asked the Maras for permission to talk to him. Vince had a few years left on his Giants contract, and the Maras were torn between graciousness and self-interest. They'd already persuaded Lombardi to reject one coaching offer and didn't feel they could ask him for patience again. He remained the most likely candidate to be their next head coach, but Jim Lee Howell had given no indications that he was ready to retire. Yes, the Packers could talk to Lombardi, Wellington Mara said, while trying to divert his Green Bay suitors to another option. Wouldn't they rather have the other Giants assistant, Tom Landry? Ole said he wanted to talk to Lombardi first. It was agreed that he could interview Vince for the job at the second winter meetings in Philadelphia, but if the Packers hired Lombardi, there had to be one caveat, Mara insisted. If the Giants needed a head coach in the future, they could try to get Lombardi back. Olenichik said he had no problem with that. Who's going to the Packers? That question was the buzz of the lobby at Philadelphia's Warwick Hotel when the league's owners and coaches gathered in late January to conduct the final 26 rounds of what was then a 30-round college draft. Green Bay's quaint status as the smallest franchise in professional sports was wearing thin among many in the pro football community. There was a growing sense, especially now that the team was so inept, that the Packers were not just an oddity, but a costly anachronism. One New York sports writer angrily confronted Olenichik near the hotel elevators and snapped, "You're nothing but parasites. You couldn't last in this league if not for the big checks you take away from other teams in the conference." Ole remained calm. "You just wait," he said. "We're going to get a man who will impress you." Early on the evening of January 22nd, he made his move, ambling up to the Giants' draft table and tapping Lombardi on the shoulder. The two men adjourned to Ole's room, where Canadeo was waiting. On the way through the lobby, they passed Ray Scott, the Packers' television announcer, who caught Vince's eye and was overcome by a sensation that he would be seeing more of that man. The sports department at the Milwaukee Journal believed differently. Running with a scoop that the CFL's Trimble was about to take the Green Bay job. The most likely choice still seemed to be Evashevsky, the big and glowering Evie, a proven leader and winner at Iowa. Could it have been mere coincidence that the Packers' top draft choice was Randy Duncan, the talented Iowa quarterback? Two assistants from Weeb Eubanks' championship Baltimore Colts were also getting late mention. But Lombardi exuded confidence in his meeting with Ole and the Gray Ghost. Though he wouldn't commit to taking the job if it were offered to him, he talked about how he would run the team, what he expected from the players, the executive committee, and himself. And he boldly broached the subject of salary, noting that he was the highest-paid assistant in the league, that his wife did not want to leave the New York area but might be persuaded by a big new house and a higher standard of living, and that along with his positions with the Giants and Federation Bank and Trust, he was a candidate to replace Colonel Blake at West Point, where excellent housing was provided by the Army. "He grabbed our attention from the first minute," said Canadeo. "He knew where he was going. In football terminology, he knew his game plan." On the Sunday morning after the draft, Evashevsky made a secret visit to Green Bay to meet with Olenichik and a few other directors. He left 4 hours later, convinced that he didn't want to relinquish his job at Iowa for the pro. That evening, Lombardi learned that he was out of the running as Blake's replacement at West Point, the Army brass having decided not to make an exception to their traditional practice of hiring only former cadets as head coaches. The news demoralized him. He grumbled to several friends that he suspected the real reason he was excluded from the job was that his last name ended in a vowel. But events were unfolding so quickly that he had little time to brood. The next day he was flown to Green Bay for an interview with the Packers. Canadeo and Bourguignon met his private plane at the airport and rode with him to the H.C. Prangy department store to meet with the company chairman, Jerry Atkinson, who was a Packers director. On the drive downtown, Bourguignon asked Lombardi whether the Maras would release him from his contract. "Jack Mara told me, 'Let your good judgment and training be your guide,'" Lombardi answered. When he explained that Mara was referring to their shared Jesuit training at Fordham, Bourguignon noted that he had been trained by the Jesuits at Marquette, to which Canadeo added, "I graduated from Gonzaga, and I've got that good judgment and training, too." Lombardi broke into a huge grin, as Canadeo later remembered it, and said, "Between the three of us Jesuits here, we could kick the shit out of these non-Catholics." He had found his first two friends in godforsaken Green Bay. At the board meeting at Prangy's, Lombardi listened more than he spoke. Atkinson took out a pen and scrawled the positives on the back of a paper placemat, making the case for coming to Green Bay. 1. More money. 2. Autonomy. He could be both coach and general manager, and the board was promising to stay out of his way. No more Monday morning quarterbacking. 3. Talent. Jack Vanisi had stocked the team with skilled young players. 4. Recognition. The Packers had nowhere to go but up, and Lombardi would get credit for their rise. 5. Living conditions. It was far cheaper to live in northeastern Wisconsin than in metropolitan New York. They would make sure he had a nice house. His children would attend fine Catholic schools. He and his wife would be welcome members at the Oneida Golf and Riding Club. After a brief but powerful statement by Lombardi, the executive board members asked him to wait in an anteroom while they held a private discussion. 20 minutes later, they called him back and made a concrete offer. As Lombardi later recounted the bargaining, "They told me the job was mine, and I told them the salary wasn't enough. I gave them another figure, which they met." The two sides agreed on $36,000 per year for 5 years. Handshakes all around. Lombardi had to take the proposal back to the Maras and Marie. Ole, Atkinson, Canadeo, and Bourguignon had to present their choice to the full board of directors. As usual, once he had made a tentative decision that would take his life in a new direction, Lombardi faltered. His normal air of certitude suddenly vanished, and he became a contradictory mess, torn between impulsiveness and introspection, hard-headed self-interest and sentimentality. The Jesuits' good judgment and training seemed of little use to him on these occasions. He could see all sides of an argument, but no right side. Before leaving Green Bay that day, he impulsively found a suitable house. But when he returned to New York and stopped by the Columbus Circle office to tell the Mara brothers about the agreement, he seemed to be hoping that they would prevent him from leaving. Instead, Well Mara declared that Green Bay was just the right place for him because as coach and general manager he could be the law unto himself out there. From New York, Lombardi drove down to Rumson, a town near his home in Fairhaven, and visited with one of his old friends, Jack Clark, a clothing store owner who loved football. Their families had been close since the days in Englewood. The Clarks were a loud and fun-loving clan, and it inevitably relaxed Lombardi to be around them. Once, when the Clarks held a pretty in pink baby shower at their house after having their first girl, Dee Dee, breaking a run of 4 boys, Lombardi rang the front doorbell dressed in a pink tutu, an incongruous vision that only the Clarks could inspire. Should he really go to Green Bay? Vin and Jack sat in the formal living room of the Clarks' spacious new house and talked about it for hours, filling the ashtray with cigarettes. Clark was a Giants fan, but also Lombardi's friend. When Lombardi left, he drove home and found Marie waiting in the kitchen with his little brother Joe. In what Joe described as a very casual manner, Vince announced that he had decided to take the job in Green Bay. And that, by the way, he had found a new house for them out there. Marie was also torn by conflicted feelings. She'd always been the one pushing Vin to get a better job to fulfill his potential to attain the prestige and money she thought he deserved. But now that the move to Green Bay seemed certain, she was distraught. The next night, she and Vin drove back to New York for a dinner of Fordham alumni at the Waldorf Astoria. Marie saw Wellington Mara there and drew him aside while her husband was talking to some old football pals from the Blocks of Granite era. She begged the owner to uphold the Giants' contract and stop Vin from leaving. "She wanted me to stop it. She begged me not to let him go to Green Bay," Mara later recalled. "I could have stopped him. This was at a time when these contracts were sacrosanct. But I didn't. I said, 'Marie, I think Green Bay is the place for him.'" The board of directors of the Green Bay Packers Incorporated, a contentious group of 45 know-it-alls, convened the next day at noon at the Hotel Northland. Their function was to approve or deny the decision of the executive committee, or Supreme Soviet. As Milwaukee Journal sports columnist Oliver Kuchel derisively labeled the smaller but more powerful group. The full board met in the Italian Room, a name that caught the attention of one writer. There were 17 reporters stuck in the makeshift press center, room 173, lounging on the bed in the chairs, sitting cross-legged on the floor, kneeling against the wall, resting on a turned-over wastebasket, coughing, cracking jokes, and clouding the room with blue smoke as the hours dragged on with no word about a new coach. It was, one said, like waiting for the puffs of smoke that signaled the election of a new pope in Rome. Inside the boardroom, every director had something to say about the future of the Packers. "Why couldn't we get Evie?" some wanted to know. "Did we try hard enough? Curly made this town. How can we turn away from him now? Why should we put so much trust in a guy from New York who's never run anything in his life?" But Ole and his allies had the votes. And when the directors had exhausted their complaints at last, the Packers hired a new coach and general manager. Ole came to the press room and, as the Press Gazette reported, read falteringly from a printed booklet which concerned the biography of a man named Lombardi. Lombardi, by previous arrangement, was in New York awaiting the call at the Hotel Manhattan. Photographers from the wire services and New York newspapers came to his room to take shots of the new head coach as he talked by telephone with reporters in Green Bay. Yes, he had some ideas about who his assistants would be. No, he didn't know much about the Packers since they were in the other conference. His first task would be to review game pictures. No, he never played pro ball. At 180 and a guard, I was a little light. No, he was not looking back to New York. I'm moving to Green Bay lock, stock, and barrel. Yes, he would take the Giants' offense with him, and only wished that he could bring Frank Gifford along, too. No, he did not expect the Packers to be as bad as last season. I have never been associated with a loser, and I don't expect to be now. As Lombardi talked, the cameras clicked. One photo showed him smiling broadly as he held the white telephone up to his left ear, his nose crinkled, eyes squinting, a large gap appearing between his two front teeth. In another picture, taken after he'd hung up, he was gazing into the mirror as he straightened his tie, two images of the same man, real and reflected, past and future, going and coming. The coming of Vince Lombardi to Green Bay completed a cycle of football mythology. Green Bay, where Curly Lambeau, founder of the Packers, taught football to Sleepy Jim Crowley, who became one of the four horsemen of Notre Dame, made famous by Grantland Rice, and went to New York to coach at Fordham, where he mentored the seven blocks of granite, among them Vince Lombardi, who ventured out to Green Bay to reclaim the glory that began with Curly Lambeau. Lombardi's first impulse was to take another block of granite with him, but Tarzan Drews reluctantly turned down an offer to coach the ends. His coaching days at Notre Dame and Marquette were over, and he planned to spend the rest of his life near the Jersey Shore. There were no round-the-clock radio sports shows in Green Bay then. The news of Lombardi's hiring spread through town that evening by word of mouth. Wayne Vanderpatten, a local broadcaster, was sitting with his sports director, Bill Howard, at a basketball game at St. Norbert College when the word was announced. "Who the hell is Vince Lombardi?" he asked. Art Daly, the Press Gazette sports writer, went around town seeking reaction to the news. The most common response was, he reported, "Who's that?" Mary over at the coffee house or Joe over at the garage aren't quite sure who is this Mr. Vince Lombardi. At the Gazette building, John B. Torinus, the publisher and a member of the Packer board, was personally overseeing an editorial welcoming the new man, relying on facts from Lombardi's resume. Over and beyond his coaching record is his scholastic record in college. He was a brilliant student. The editorial repeated the old Lombardi embellishments, that he was on the dean's list at Fordham and had graduated cum laude, and concluded, "Everyone in Green Bay will wish him well, for we are all in this together." At the breakfast shop the next morning, the men in Martha's Coffee Club were gossiping about the big news in the morning paper. There was a guest story in the Press Gazette from a New York writer, Joe King, who said the people of Green Bay might mistake the new coach for a teacher of Romance languages who was about ready to earn his full professorship at an eminent college. With his kindly, almost benign smile, his self-effacing manners, the horn-rimmed specs. But there was another side to him, King warned. Lombardi is moody, Latinish, depressed, explosive from time to time. This account made the Martha's gang more curious and anxious about the new head coach. Funeral director, plumber, insurance man, office supply merchant, sheet metal salesman, all the fellows in the coffee club lived and died for the Packers. For 10 long years, they mostly had been dying. After Scooter McLean, they were ready for a major change, but the naming of Lombardi took them by surprise. Green Bay was a city of Catholics, French, Belgium, Irish, German, and Polish, but the number of Italians then could almost be counted on two hands. Canadeo, Mazzolini, Venisi, the Bellotti brothers over at the Forum Supper Club. There were none in Martha's Coffee Club. "It sounded as though we were getting a foreign-type person," said John Ebert, the office supply store owner. "He was from New York. We wondered how he would do in Green Bay, Wisconsin. There was desperation for anyone to come and succeed, and all of a sudden here comes this guy, Vince Lombardi." The Green Bay Packers Alumni Association, less concerned about Lombardi's Eastern background, issued a formal statement expressing its confidence that the Lombardi plan for resurgence will pay dividends, and that the thrill of good, sound, and representative football will again be a part of the everyday life of the citizens of Green Bay and Wisconsin. When Bart Starr, the young Packers quarterback, first heard the news, he barely recognized the name and knew nothing about Lombardi beyond the fact that he had been a Giants assistant. Then Starr saw the picture in the morning newspaper, the glasses and the determined eyes and the gap-toothed smile. Yes, he did know something about this man, one moment etched in his memory. It hit him like a lightning bolt, who this Lombardi was. His mind flashed back to a preseason game at Fenway Park in Boston, where the Packers played the Giants. Green Bay had just scored, and Starr, after holding for the extra point, was jogging off the field. Both teams were on the same side of the gridiron in the center field area. As Starr ran past the Giants' bench, he saw this person yelling and screaming at the defense of the Giants. When he saw Lombardi's face in the paper, he realized